Ms. Middleman.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court.
Morning.
Elaine Middleman for Jose Cantu. The question in this case is whether his July 2011 letter to the state post-conviction court can be considered a properly filed tolling motion.
Did the letter collaterally attack his conviction or sentence, or did it simply ask for a reinstatement?
Judge, I mean, he had about 3 weeks before asked to withdraw his plea, his motion, and then apparently he found out some other information. This is what he said in this.
No, but tell us what's in the, what does the letter say?
He just said he wants to reinstate the motion.
And that's all it says?
I believe that's correct, yes. Because he said his attorney had given him bad advice. And the docket, he wrote it in a letter form, there's no question about that. The docket shows, it lists it as a motion, the docket entry, I think it's 233, listed as a motion, and so I think the main question is.
Suppose he had been successful. Suppose the court had reinstated his right to pursue his post-conviction motion.
Right.
Would that satisfy what you have to do to get relief?
That's a very good question. I think one of the kind of unspoken issues is if the court had reinstated his, motion, whether that would relate back to whatever, it'd be like a motion for reconsideration, really, in a regular case, so that it would relate back to whatever he had said in the original motion. So that's what I think he was trying to do, and so I think that it would have just gone forward from that point.
But in a motion for reconsideration, obviously the court has already made an initial decision. Did the court ever make any decision on his petition?
That's another good question. No, and I think that's another important issue because, I think that our Tews case, when Justice Scalia talks about what has to be properly filed, but there really isn't, from the cases I read, that discussion of who and when decides that. And so I think Judge Hinkle in the Dieter case made a very good point that you can't have, or you shouldn't anyway, have no action on a case, and years later they say, oh, it wasn't properly filed. So this just sat there, whether the court or the judge knew it was there, I don't know, it was docketed. So, there needs to be some way of timely addressing these things. I think that, again, that's the point Judge Hinkle made. And so if the state had responded and said at that time, this was not properly filed, this is a letter, we're not supposed to do that, then at least that would have been, brought to the court's attention. But this way, nothing happened at all. And that's why he filed the motion, a petition for a belated appeal, which really I don't think is an issue here, but that was why he then took, at least I believe that's why he took that step on his own some months later to get the thing moving. Then it got sent back to the court again, and then it was denied, so.
Well, there's at least one Florida Supreme Court case that addresses a petitioner's request to reinstate his or her motion after withdrawing it and addresses it on the merits. Right? Do you think that case is helpful in any way to your position?
I'm not sure what case that is, to be honest with you.
It's Treese, Treese versus State. The citation's 41 Southern 3rd, 119, and it's a Florida Supreme Court case from 2010. And in that case, the petitioner had filed a motion or made a request to waive post-conviction proceedings and counsel, was granted, then filed a motion to withdraw that waiver and start everything back all over again. The state trial court denied it. And then because it was a capital case, it went straight up to the Florida Supreme Court. And the Florida Supreme Court denied relief, but did so on the merits of the motion. In other words, that the request to reinstate on the merits wasn't a meritorious one. Mm-hmm. And that the state trial court had denied correctly the motion to reinstate. But doesn't at all suggest that you can't have one of those motions filed.
I think... If it's all right with the court, if I read that case and maybe I can supplement, you know, to answer your question, but
no, if we need supplemental briefing from either side, we'll let you know.
Okay.
But there is that one case out there.
What I was going to say was, as I think you're pointing out, there's a distinction, and Artis said this, between deciding something on the merits and deciding whether it's proper. I think that's what Justice Scalia was saying. What's properly filed, it's not an issue of whether the claim is valid or not. And so in this case, the issue was being properly filed. And I was going to say, not that necessarily the docket is, you know, the be-all and end-all, but the fact that it was listed on the docket wouldn't have put Mr. Cantu in notice that it wasn't properly filed, if you see what I'm saying. And since no one came back to him, again, the case law is a little confused as to who has a duty, or if anyone, to say, oh, no, that wasn't correct. But at a minimum, as Judge Hinkle said, I don't think it's really helpful to anybody to wait till years later to have to somehow debate. In other words, there should have been some process at that time to allow him, if it was not properly filed, to correct or amend. You know, he did have that, should have had that opportunity, if it wasn't properly filed, to, you know, right at that time, correct it, and then it would have been hopefully properly filed. And there are cases about that.
The District Court of Appeal remanded the matter to the state trial court for it to rule on his letter motion, right?
Yes, but that was later, yes.
No, I know.
Okay,
I know. Yes. But at first, the letter motion, whatever it was not acted upon.
That's correct.
Right, for
it
a
was
while.
Sitting there, yes.
Right, and then when he went up to the District Court of Appeal, that court remanded it for the state trial court to take some action on the letter motion.
That's exactly right. And the Court of Appeal said, you know, we don't have an appeal pending. So that
right.
Yes.
Because there hadn't been an order from below.
Right. Nothing had happened. That's what I'm saying. So, I understand the courts often get letters from inmates. So it's not totally surprising that maybe they said, well, this is just a letter. But it did not say that on the docket. And so, you know, I think something, again, I'm not sure whose duty it is, but to have something to sit there with nothing happening at all, and then to somehow, and while the time is going by for his deadline to file, I think that was probably where the problem happened. And I just want to clarify one more thing. Even at the hearing where he withdrew his motion, and the judge said to him, you know, I don't want you coming back with a letter in 3 weeks and saying you want to even with that, his letter did explain why he was doing that he felt like he had been given bad advice by his attorney. So, he wouldn't have theoretically known that at the time that the judge said to him, I don't want you coming back with a letter. So I think he probably thought coming back with a letter possibly was what he was supposed to do, you know, because he had.
Well, let me ask you a related question, and it may be a little bit unfair. And this is one that I might ask you for supplemental briefing
okay,
on.
Sure.
Because it's not in the COA, but it's something that follows if the COA question is decided in your favor. The state trial court denied the motion to reinstate, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even if that letter motion told the period for filing a habeas petition, how has Mr. Cantu exhausted his ineffectiveness claims if that motion to reinstate was denied?
To be honest, I don't know. I'd have to answer the question. I don't know.
Right, because it's one thing to say,
I mean, wouldn't that be on the merit? I'll say, that's a very good question. I don't know.
Well, it's not merits, it's procedural,
right?
Because if.
But it would have.
That's why I acknowledge that it's a partially unfair question, but I'm going to ask your colleague the same thing. Because it's one thing to say that the letter motion may have told the statutory period, right? Because it was properly filed under your theory.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that we get to review the state trial court's denial of that letter motion. And if the denial of that letter motion is accepted as correct under state law, then that means that he never pursued his ineffectiveness claims through the state court process.
I don't know if that's in the record.
I
was going to say that the only possible answer I could give you right now without further research is that the state's response was just on the limited issue of timeliness, so they did not address.
Understood. And that's why
okay.
it may not have been, you know, apparent.
It was a very good question. I give you credit for that. Wish I had a better answer.
We try to get paid for those. We're trying to get increase in salary for good questions.
Okay, I'll give you A+ on that question. As I said, in reflecting, I've tried to read a lot of these cases, which there are so many of these cases, but it does seem like the question that no one really seems to discuss is when and how do you decide whether it's properly filed, and given with the idea that this time is running, so it isn't something you can just wait till later to decide, because by the time it's decided, wouldn't have had the opportunity to amend or correct the letter motion to the extent it was incorrectly filed. And there are cases that talk about the court instructed the defendant, you need to re-amend your petition or whatever, and they do that. So, and then the time hasn't lapsed.
Isn't there possibly a question other than whether it was properly filed, though? And that question is what the letter really was, whether it was actually an attack, a collateral attack on his sentence or his conviction, or whether it was just a motion for reconsideration or some sort of attack on his waiver, which are two different things, right?
Right. I think that that's why I talked about relating back. I think it would essentially just restart reopen for consideration the motion, which would be on the merits. That's why I call it, to me, it would be like a motion for consideration where the underlying order would also be at issue. So that's the way I read it anyway.
All right, thank you very much.
You
saved your time for rebuttal, Ms. Middleman. Mr. Tannen.
May it please the court, my name is Jonathan Tannen, representing the Secretary of the Florida Department of Corrections, and we are requesting that the judgment of the district court be affirmed. Before I get to the merits, Your Honors, I did want to make sure the court is aware that Mr. Cantu completed his sentence and has been released from custody. I know it doesn't create any kind of a mootness issue under this court's precedent, but the court has, I think, noted it in the past when the situation has arisen, so I just wanted to make sure the court was aware. On the merits, Your Honors, the letter in this case was not a properly filed application for post-conviction or other collateral review within the meaning of Section 2244. There are two problems with the letter in that regard. First, it wasn't an application for collateral review, and secondly, it wasn't a properly filed motion or application under Florida law. As far as the substantive issues, Your Honor, the letter was not a collateral attack on the judgment itself. It only sought reinstatement of the post-conviction proceeding that Mr. Cantu had previously voluntarily withdrawn.
Suppose he had prevailed on that, what would have happened?
If he had prevailed on the motion?
On the reinstatement.
I think the circuit court would have had to address his motion for post-conviction relief on the merits, presumably.
And all of that time would have been told?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think...
under what theory?
Because
saying that maybe the state court got the ruling on the reinstatement wrong, but once it dealt with the merits and ruled against him, how could that not be told time?
Well, the problem with the letter, Your Honors, is that it wasn't a collateral attack on the judgment itself. He was trying to his actual post-conviction proceeding at that point was no longer pending, which
once the court grants it, it is pending.
The post-conviction proceeding. I mean, I think it would depend on how quickly the court acted on the motion to reinstate. I don't think this court has addressed the question of what happens when a petition for belated appeal or something along those lines is granted.
But usually that amount of time doesn't matter. If a state court grants a petition for a belated appeal, for example, even if it sat on it for 3 years,
mm-hmm.
it counts, right? So the amount of time that a court might have sat on Mr. Cantu's motion shouldn't be determinative one way or the other, right?
Well, I think the problem with the letter in this case was that it wasn't a motion to begin with.
Right, that's a different question altogether, but the amount of time that a court waits to rule on something
mm-hmm.
it can't be determinative, right? The question is, what is the thing?
Right.
If it's an appropriate tolling motion under the statute, then it doesn't matter how long the state court waits to rule on it, right? Because if the state
right.
court, if it's an appropriate motion and the state court waits 7 years to rule on it,
mm-hmm.
all that time is told.
That's correct, Your Honor. But that presumes that the letter itself was actually a
tolling. Of course, yes.
2244. The problem with the motion is that it didn't collaterally attack the judgment itself. In Espinoza versus Secretary of Department of Corrections, this court addressed the very similar circumstance of whether a petition for belated appeal from a post-conviction proceeding that had become final was a tolling motion for purposes of Section 2244, and the court held that it wasn't. In order to be a collateral attack on the judgment, it actually has to go to the merits of the judgment itself or seek a seek an examination or alteration of the judgment and sentence. In this case, that simply isn't what occurred here. And in Espinoza, the court held that with respect to the petition for belated appeal, if the petition for belated appeal had been granted, that wouldn't have actually given the defendant any relief on the merits of the judgment or sentence itself. It would have simply resulted in a reinstatement of the post-conviction proceeding that had previously become final. And the court cited Coley v. Wall, where the Supreme Court also talked about other types of post-conviction motions that aren't themselves collateral attacks on the judgment for purposes of Section 2244. Things like a motion for post-conviction discovery or a motion for post-conviction counsel. These are things that, if the relief sought in the motion is granted, it would, I suppose, bring the defendant a step closer to obtaining post-conviction relief. But the motions themselves aren't post-conviction motions. And that was what this court held was true of the petition for belated appeal. It would have resulted in a reinstatement of the post-conviction proceeding and further review of the post-conviction proceeding, but there wouldn't actually have been any relief granted with respect to the judgment itself. And that's exactly the circumstance here. So,
is there a way for a person in Mr. Cantu's position to toll the statute in this type of a situation? Is there something that he could have done that would have told the clock?
I think he might have, I don't know if there was anything he could have done under Florida law to toll the motion other than file a new post-conviction proceeding once it had been withdrawn. I mean, at this point, it would have been untimely if he had done that. I think in order to protect his federal habeas rights, if he had wanted to do that, he would have had to file some kind of protective petition in the district court and seek a stay while he tried to pursue his post-conviction remedies in state court. But once the post-conviction proceeding was withdrawn, there was no longer a post-conviction, there was no longer a pending collateral attack in state court that would have told his post-conviction application.
Do you know what Florida, I'm sorry.
No, please go ahead.
Do you know what Florida courts, how Florida courts would have responded to a secondary petition?
I think it would have, if it had been timely, I think he might have been able to proceed on it. In this case, it would have been more than 2 years after the judgment and sentence became final. So he couldn't have done that in this case. I think the only way he could proceed was by having his Rule 3850 proceeding reinstated. And as the court is aware, the circuit court denied that and the Second District Court of Appeal affirmed. So I think once he withdrew his petition, there was, as the circuit judge warned him, there was really nothing he could do. But in any event,
that goes to the merits of whether or not his motion was letter motion, if you consider it, that was meritorious or not, not whether it told.
Exactly, Your Honor. I mean, the question for our purposes is whether the letter motion was actually a tolling motion for purposes of Section 2244. And under the court's reasoning in Espinoza, it wasn't. It didn't result in any kind of collateral attack on the judgment itself, and it didn't actually make any mention of the underlying merits.
What if it had? Would that change your view? If it had, if the contents had attacked the waiver, but also had said, and by the way, my conviction was unconstitutional for these 15 reasons, would that have been a collateral attack such that?
It might have been a collateral attack, but it still wouldn't have been properly filed because it would have been an untimely collateral attack. So on the face of it, it wasn't a collateral attack, but I'll use that as a segue into the second issue, which is that it wasn't properly filed.
Before you get there, if to go back to Judge Dubina's initial question, if the state trial court on remand from the District Court of Appeal had taken a different route and granted the letter motion, let him reinstate, What would your position be here today?
I think my position, I mean, I'm not aware of any precedent where the court has addressed that specifically.
No, I know.
I think it would still be untimely because there would have been no pending post-conviction proceeding during that time when he was trying to have his post-conviction proceeding reinstated. I mean, that's the problem with the letter, is that it wasn't actually a collateral attack on the judgment itself. I mean, I guess if it would depend on how the court wanted to treat it. If the court determined that the petition for belated appeal or the letter was in effect a notice of appeal, maybe under those circumstances it would, you know, be considered a tolling motion from the time it was filed. But again, in order to get there, first the letter, well, it's entirely hypothetical because the circuit court didn't grant it in this case. So I can't really address fully what would have happened if the circuit court have done that. I think for our purposes, the question is simply whether the letter was itself a tolling motion under Section 2244. And again, under Espinoza, it wasn't. On the issue of whether the letter was properly filed, what the Supreme Court has said is that the term properly filed refers to compliance with applicable laws and rules governing filings, including the form of the document, the time limits upon its delivery, the filing fee, and things of that nature. The Supreme Court discussed that in Artuse versus Bennett. And here, the letter on its face didn't comply with any of the requirements for a motion or any type of application under Florida law, let alone an application for post-conviction relief.
What didn't it have?
It didn't have a designation identifying itself as a motion.
But Florida courts have, there are a number of Florida cases in the DCAs treating letters from pro se litigants, including prisoners, as motions.
Right, but the court in this case, I mean, I think it might be a different circumstance if the court had actually treated it as a motion.
But see, then our decision is based on what the state court does with it?
I mean, I think the court can look at the letter itself and see whether it complies with state court requirements. In terms of...
Well, what else was missing?
It didn't comply with the requirements for a post-conviction filing under Rule 3850. It wasn't under oath. It wasn't, again, submitted within 2 years of the time that it was filed. And, I would just point out, nothing on the face of the letter identified it as a motion that
The letter was filed within 2 years.
Of the judgment becoming final?
Yes, was it not?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor. The judgment became
He didn't file an appeal. Right?
That's correct, Your Honor. The judgment
and he filed final. When did he file his state post-conviction motion?
He filed the state post-conviction motion. The original post-conviction motion, Your Honor, was filed on May 8th, 2008. The conviction became final on December 17th, 2007, when his time to appeal expired. The letter itself wasn't sent until 2011.
Okay.
So that was, the letter itself wouldn't have completed.
Over the 2 year period.
Exactly, Your Honor. The letter itself, we would submit, was not a properly filed application under Florida law. As far as the issue of the court not addressing it, I don't think that is dispositive in this case. I think we can look at the form of the document itself and see that it didn't comply. But I think one of the other problems with it is that it didn't give any notice to the state circuit court that it was actually a petition for relief. I think the clerk had originally docketed it as a post-conviction motion and then redocketed it as a as simply correspondence to the clerk.
But didn't you say that, do you mean a petition for any sort of relief or a petition for?
The letter, Your Honor? It did not, it didn't give any indication that it was a petition for any sort of relief, at least on the face of it. You had to read to the bottom of the second page before, you know, you got to what he was actually asking for. And I think this is, you know, one of the reasons that state courts typically require documents to be in the form that they are is so that the judges know what's being requested, so that non-lawyer court staff knows where a particular document is supposed to go, And in this case, there was nothing on the face of it that would have required it to, that would have given any indication that it was a motion that was requesting any sort of relief. And again, in addition to that, even if it could be considered a collateral application, it didn't comply with the specific requirements for a collateral application under Florida law.
Let me ask you the same question I asked Ms. Middleman, which is, if she's right on this issue and you're wrong, or at least we think that she's right and that you're wrong, isn't there still an exhaustion problem?
Right, then we would have to get to the question of whether the petition was exhausted, which hasn't been briefed in this appeal. It wasn't briefed in the district court because the district court determined on the face of it that it was
untimely.
So I think in
the state, did the state move to dismiss on exhaustion grounds as well, or no?
No, the response was limited to the
timeliness. Okay, thank you. Right.
Does the court have any additional questions? All right, well, I will conclude there and simply request that the judgment be affirmed.
Thank you very much.
Just have a couple points. On the terms of the tolling, I'll be honest, I find this all very confusing, but I think that the time up until June 2011 was tolled because that's when they were going to have the evidentiary hearing, and it was at that hearing when he said he was withdrawing. So I think that the letter would have been timely, I believe, because there was a tolling from 2008, I believe, till 2011.
Mr. Tannen's argument is that if you consider the letter motion to be some request for post-conviction relief, it was not properly filed under Florida law because it was filed more than 2 years after the judgment became final. I think that's what he was trying to say, one of his arguments.
I don't know if that's correct or not. I've just been, because I think my impression was that letter would have been timely, but the petition for belated appeal that he filed like 6 months later would not have been timely, but I can double check that if you want me to do that. The other point I wanted to make was I think all the argument about Espinoza and what's required for petition for belated appeal really has nothing to do with the issue here, because that type of petition concerns the timeliness and everything else of why you didn't appeal, not the merits. So even though it sounds like it's related, I don't think the holding of Espinoza has any bearing on what we're talking about today. Thank you.
Thank you both very much. We appreciate it.